Anyway, when we are so funny and so glib that nothing ever makes us go, ooh, why, you know, I ought to get serious about this, then that's not good. It can amount to a ridiculing of the gospel and the holy demands of God if we're not careful. And in that sense, language can be used to withdraw from God's presence. Instead of our language leading us to know God better, to respect Him more, to stand in fear of Him in the proper sense more, our language can just kind of make everything a joke. So there is a place for humor. I've tried to show you some positive uses for it. I've also tried to show you a pitfall of making everything a joke, being too humorous. Don't ask me, where do you draw the line? This requires a degree of wisdom. You know, we have to grow up in the Lord and have maturity so we can tell that some situations humor is good, in other situations it's not appropriate. Not going to help out. All right, F on your outline, the use of language in literature and drama. Is it ever appropriate, is it ever morally legitimate to write in a novel or to speak in a dramatic production, a movie or a play, what have you, something which Christians should not say? Is it ever appropriate to write in a novel or to speak in a play or a movie something which Christians would not be expected and should not say? A vulgarity, let's say, or even worse, a blasphemy. Should a Christian ever write a novel? Let's start there. Should a Christian ever write a novel where one of the characters utters a blasphemy, curses the name of God?
Yes.
What's that?
Yes.
Okay, depending on the character, Melissa says, the answer would be yes. What if the novel is about or includes the portrayal of somebody who's a blasphemous character? Are we to believe that Christian literature means that we don't ever portray what the world says or does? That in Christian novels, no one ever commits adultery or says, God damn it. I think that's highly artificial. I don't even think that that pleases God when we so sanitize the world that we don't tell people the way it is. Now then, I do have a lot of problem when such people are portrayed in Christian writing or in a Christian movie or what have you, as though that's perfectly acceptable. Now, I know that you can't have an artificial, the red flag goes up every time, in parentheses. Of course, God's unhappy about that. No, but I mean, you can portray it subtly and with literary skill in such a way that this is the kind of person that leads the following kind of life and has the following kinds of consequences in his or her life. That is, we shouldn't portray good, well-meaning people, except, of course, they blaspheme God's name. That would be an unethical overall portrayal. But specifically, to avoid having a character blaspheme, commit adultery, whatever, is, it seems to me, almost a denial of the truth, a refusal to have realism in what you're saying or doing. Does the Bible ever portray unbelievers as saying and doing things which are bad? Yeah, interesting. The writing of the Bible doesn't edit out the sins of unbelievers. Sometimes some of the things they say. Go ahead.
I think it's not so true that it is not, so to speak, explicit in detail, such as like the rape of Dinah Bathsheba.
Well, by modern standards of pornography, what you're saying is correct. The Bible does not go into that kind of explicit detail. I guess what I'm wanting to say here is I'm not sure how relevant that observation is, however, because the Bible is written for a particular purpose, And not all literature has to be written for the same purpose as the Bible. And somebody could say, yes, well, in the Bible, there's no need to go into that kind of detail. The point is well enough made. But for what I'm trying to do, greater detail, more graphic detail is called for. Don't get me wrong, Jay. I'm not saying that anybody could justify the kind of graphic detail that we call pornography. But I'm not sure that I want to say we can say only as much as the Bible does about the sins of people. There may be more to it than that. Right, right. And it has to be remembered that when the Bible talks about the blasphemies and vulgarities of people, it always does it for our edification. For our edification. This may be an even bigger point than what Jay has already pointed out for us. People who write such graphic, ugly things today don't do it for our edification, do they? They're not doing it to draw us closer to God. They're doing it to relish in living far from God, as though there is no God. And so our sermons, as well as our books, our stage plays, or our movies, should also be done for the edification of God's people. That is to say, in one way or another, it doesn't have to be preachy, it doesn't have to be wooden, but in one way or another, they should demonstrate the degradation of unbelief, the foolishness of unbelief, the consequences of a life that doesn't walk with God, to show vividly what sin really is like. You know, and that's the problem with so much graphic material in modern literature and film that's vulgar or blasphemous or pornographic for that matter. The problem is it presents sin as though it's good. Or it's just run-of-the-mill, acceptable, no problem here. I think we ought to have movies, plays, novels, sermons even, that really do vividly portray sin for what it is. Sin is not happy. Sin is not beautiful. Sin does not bring good results. So if we are to be true to the facts of life, as God has us to see life, those things should be portrayed. I'm afraid among many Christians, it's almost like we think the devil has the best advertising space, you know? So movies, we just have to give movies over to all of this stuff that is unacceptable to us. And what can we do? We can't counter that. Oh, yes, we can. I counsel people who have suffered greatly from sexual infidelity. I counsel people who have had horrible lives because they ignored God and disrespected Him and blasphemed Him and so forth. So the answer, it seems to me, about literature and drama is that we have to be realistic. We also have to show reserve, nothing more than what is appropriate to the occasion. And for us, the intention of portraying these things is always for edification and truth-telling, not for reveling in something or numbing people to the unholiness of what we're talking about. A lot of interesting issues under the third commandment. I haven't covered everything, and I may not be right in everything I've said, but I hope I've given you enough to think them through. Every sin violates the third commandment. We are not to desecrate or use God's name lightly. It is appropriate to call upon God's name in oaths as long as our oaths are only in select, serious, legal situations. Our language should be pure, but that does not mean that it excludes expressions of contempt. There is a good use of humor, also a unsanctifying use of humor. And in literature and drama, we should be realistic and therefore sometimes use vulgarities, blasphemies, however, always for the edifying end of showing what sin really is like. Anything you want to add, ask, clarify?
Actually, what sort of category would you fit the humor of someone who makes jokes, say, about St. Peter and the Gates of Heaven and Christ and all the great Christians?
Probably I'd apply the same rule of thumb. If it's done for edification, then I could imagine using a St. Peter at the Gates of Heaven story. However, I feel really bad if in telling such jokes I gave people the idea that St. Peter really has such a function. But you see, we know that angels don't float on clouds either. But I can see a cartoon with an angel floating on a cloud saying something and get the point of the joke. It's like a setup, as it were. So if we're using it only as a setup and no one's going to take us as thinking that's a serious theological premise, I don't have any problem with it. Provided the humor is edifying, you know.
Would like art fall under the literature and drama?
Yes.
That's something that
it also falls under the Sunday.
Well, I think she meant art outside of the church or outside of worship, right?
Yeah, I meant that. Yeah. I'm
writing down the fourth commandment, but I'm not done with the first three yet, since I'm up. Thought I would start out with that on the board. I want to take a minute or two and talk about the apologetical import of the first three commandments. The application of the first three commandments to apologetics. And you have to just forgive me, since apologetics is my field of training and expertise. I can't help but write a hobby verse. And so now I'd like to take a few moments in ethics and talk about apologetics. There are three basic areas of apologetical answer or defense. Three basic areas. First of all, we have to answer people who are in irreligious unbelief. Irreligious unbelief. That is pure, unadulterated opposition from atheist, secularist, humanist. The irreligious, who don't want any religion at all, as they would say. Their unbelief is that of heathenism. Secondly, we run into people whose unbelief is of a religious sort. Here we have the false religions of the world, the idolaters of the world. They wouldn't be against religion, but they're against the Christian religion. Everyone with me? Thirdly, we run into Christian unbelief. Here, Christian has to be put in quotes. Professedly Christian unbelief. Here I refer to the people who propagate unorthodox theology, who are heretics, and yet they're heretics in the name of Jesus. Okay, so Christian unbelief. They are not true believers, but they claim the Bible in some way, or they call upon the name of Jesus in some way. So three basic areas of apologetical answer: irreligious unbelief, religious unbelief, and Christian unbelief. Now, all sin is a violation of every commandment. We've begun to see that. All sin falls under the first commandment. All sin falls under the second commandment. All sin falls under the third commandment. All sin is a violation of every commandment. But there is a special application of each of these three commandments. We talked about the Masonic order under the first commandment. We talked about exclusive solemnity under the second, and talked about vulgarity and language under the third. So there are specific focuses or foci of the commandments. And if you stop and think about it, the first three commandments address those three areas of apologetics that I just referred to. What's the first area of apologetical answer? Irreligious unbelief. God says in the first commandment, you are to have no other gods before me. People who are irreligious unbelievers are violating especially the first commandment, because they have other gods, other ultimate authorities, other basic standards of truth or right or beauty than God himself. So here you have people that have false philosophies. You have those that are heathen unbelievers, atheists, secularists, humanist, who make man the measure of all things rather than God the measure of all things. Those who are in irreligious unbelief are especially guilty of violating the first commandment. They have some other ultimate authority in their life. Make sense? The second area of unbelief, I said, is religious unbelief. Here you have people in false religions, Hinduism, whatever, who are violating the prohibition of vain worship by images. God says, you're not to worship me by your own imagination. Don't try to make up your own religion. There's to be no religion by man's devices, that is, according to man's imagination or speculation. But isn't that what false religions are? Buddhism, Hinduism, so forth, even the Quran. These are religions according to man's imagination. So they especially violate the second commandment. And now thirdly, how about those who are Christian, in quotes, Christian unbelievers, the unorthodox theologians, the heretics among us? The Bible forbids a vain use of God's name. Isn't that specifically what they do? The false pretense of following Christ. They take Christ's name. They invoke the Bible. They'll speak about God and so forth. And yet they do so falsely. They take up God's name in vain. So then, before we leave these three commandments, I just wanted to remind you, they have an interesting character to them. Each of these commandments summarizes all sin. And if you look at these three commandments in their particular focus, the first three commandments indict all the unbelief of the world. Atheists on the one hand, false religions, secondly, and Christian heretics, thirdly. And so that should also give a real fire and zeal to our apologetical efforts. We have to remember that out of an ethical concern for the first commandment, we ought to answer atheist. Out of an ethical concern for the second commandment, we ought to answer false religionist. Out of an ethical concern for the third commandment, we ought to answer heretics. We ought to rebuke them for taking God's name in vain. Okay, that's it for the first three commandments. Any lingering questions or comments that you want to make? Okay, if not, then we will take a 5-minute break and then have our last hour together this afternoon. All right, as we continue our discussion of ethical issues summarized around the Decalogue, we come to the fourth commandment, which is the Sabbath commandment, where there is absolutely no controversy in the Christian church and everything is exactly clear now. Obviously a very controversial part of the law and one that has been disputed, and there are schools of interpretation and then there are divisions within the schools of interpretation and so forth. So I'm not going to pretend to settle everything, but I would like to touch on the contours of the Sabbath commandment. We find it in Exodus 20. Beginning at verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath unto Jehovah thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days Jehovah made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore Jehovah blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Here we have the requirement of working 6 days and resting on the seventh set out for us as a creation ordinance. That is to say, one of the regulations God has given for human life from creation and based on the creation order itself. Notice that the requirement is not just a rest requirement, it is also a work requirement. It is a positive obligation. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. When we do not pursue gainful employment, when we do not try to work hard and long at our callings, the vocation God has given us, then we have violated the Sabbath commandment. I'm afraid that we have the wrong understanding or approach to the commandment, and we see it just as a religious ordinance about Sunday rest. It is a commandment that covers all of life, working or resting, and in the way that God tells us to do that. And that's interesting because human life is made up of that, resting and working, right? Activity and rest. Recreation and activity. Rest and restoration. God says you're to work 6 days, but the Sabbath is to be kept holy. The seventh day is to be kept holy unto Jehovah thy God. In that day you're not to work. And not only are you not to work, your family's not to work. And all those who are under your authority are not to work. Indeed, all those who are under your roof are not to work, the stranger that is within your gates. And why is that? Because in 6 days Jehovah made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore Jehovah blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. All of our life is to be lived in the imitation of God, right? And here's a concrete illustration. God worked 6 days, then he rested on the seventh. And in so doing, he hallowed, he made special, the seventh day. Likewise, you are to work 6 days, and you are to hallow the seventh. Now, because the Sabbath is a creation ordinance, as it's presented here, it's not just a creation ordinance in Jewish perspective. It is a creation ordinance in divine perspective. God is the one who gives the commandment and refers to his own activity and rest pattern as the basis for why human beings should live this way. Since it's a creation ordinance, is there going to be a change of the Sabbath pattern with the coming of the Redeemer, Jesus Christ? Are dispensationalists right to see this as just a Jewish ordinance confined to the Old Testament and to the Jews? No, they aren't, because God lays this out as something having to do with creation. So during the whole era of creation, and for all of those who live within creation, it is a truth that God created in 6 days, rested a seventh, and hallowed it. So we are to work 6 days and to rest a seventh and hallow that day. So notice that Exodus 20 presents the Sabbath as a creation ordinance. Next point in your outline, B, the Sabbath is likewise a redemptive ordinance. In Exodus 20, we have the giving of the law to Moses at Mount Sinai at the outset of the wilderness wanderings. But as you know, the law was repeated to the Israelites prior to their entering the land, that is at the end of their wilderness wanderings. So turn to the second giving of the law found in Deuteronomy chapter 5. What does Deuteronomy mean, by the way, the word Deuteronomy? Second law or second giving of the law. It's the law over again, Deuteronomy. Now what do we read? The second time the law is given with respect to the Sabbath commandment. Deuteronomy 5, reading at the 12th verse. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as Jehovah thy God commanded thee. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath unto Jehovah thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor in any of thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest, as well as thou. But now listen. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and Jehovah thy God brought thee out thence by a mighty hand, and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, Jehovah thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. Where's the reference to creation now in the second giving of the law? There isn't any. Well, then what is the reason for the Sabbath requirement according to Deuteronomy?
Redemption.
You shall remember that you were servants in the land of Egypt. God brought you out with a mighty hand, outstretched arm. Therefore, Jehovah thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. Now the motivation for the Sabbath day, it's not different, I mean it's different, it's not contrary to it being a creation ordinance, but Israel has an even greater reason to keep the Sabbath day, because not only has God created Israel, or the people who are Israelites, he has recreated them, he has redeemed them. And so the Sabbath has a redemptive reflection in it as well. When people rest on the Sabbath day, they're giving testimony to what? Not just that they are created, but that they are redeemed and they can rest in God. Now we trust that our liberation comes not from our own efforts and work, but what? We rest in God's provision. The Sabbath is a gracious provision. It shows that we don't rely upon ourselves. If we had to rely upon ourselves for our life, much less our eternal life, we'd work every day. Work, 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 work. Strive, 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 strive. Effort, 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 effort. But not for God's people. God's people work 6 days and then we glorify God and we rest, saying we know everything comes from him. He liberates us. He redeems us. He saves us. And so the Sabbath is a creation ordinance. It's also a redemptive ordinance. And does this help us in any way to understand how the Sabbath should be understood in our day and age? We have people who say, well, Christians ought to keep the Sabbath, but unbelievers don't have to. No, I'm more inclined to say, as a creation ordinance, we know that everyone is to keep the Sabbath. But as a redemption ordinance, it has special significance for Christians. So Christians may keep the Sabbath in a way that unbelievers don't. In particular, Christians will worship on the Sabbath, unbelievers will not. But because they do have a God who made them, it is their moral obligation not to work and not to force other people to work. However, believers are not going to work and in the process remember their redemption. Does that help? Kind of a two-tiered approach. Everyone observes it as a creation ordinance. Believers keep the Sabbath as a redemptive ordinance as well. And the redemptive significance of the Sabbath is reflected in the system of Sabbaths that is set up in the Mosaic economy. For as you know, the Sabbath was not simply a weekly requirement, but they were to observe Sabbath years as well. Every seventh year was a Sabbath year. And what happened in the Sabbath year? There was a reflection of being set free. All debts are remitted, set free. All slaves now regain their freedom, are set free. In the Sabbath year, your fields rest. In the Sabbath year, your farm animals rest. Wow. What would it take for a farmer to rest 1 year out of seven? It would take a lot of faith in God, wouldn't it? That his provision will be adequate in the sixth year to carry you through. What are you symbolizing by that faith? That you trust that God will renew the ground. And so, in a sense, the Sabbath year looks forward to the new creation, the trust that God is going to renew all of the created order. He doesn't just set free his people. He sets free their animals. He sets free their land. So everything in the created order is being renewed according to God's provision, that in which we have faith. Now, after seven cycles of Sabbath years, what do you get? In the 50th year, the Jubilee. Okay? The Jubilee is the Sabbath of Sabbaths. Okay? So here you have this 7 times 7 perfection. Again, that indicates the Sabbath has a redemptive or ceremonial typology to it. It looks ahead to the coming of salvation and the provision of a new creation wherein righteousness will dwell. Everything will be renewed and men will be set free. Set free from the bondage of sin. In the Old Testament, part of the symbolism of the Sabbath system was found in the Feast of Pentecost. The Feast of Pentecost was an 8th day Sabbath celebration. You celebrate the Sabbath on the 7th day, and then the 8th day is the Sabbath as well. And Pentecost, of course, looks to God's provision, His Holy Spirit, are bringing the sustenance of life to His people. On the day of Pentecost in the New Testament, 50 days, seven sevens, and then the day following, we have the giving of the Holy Spirit. Okay? So I can't go through all of it. We don't have the time, and I haven't got the preparation, but I do hope I have whet your appetites as to the beauty of the Sabbath symbolism that is found as a redemptive ordinance looking ahead to the liberation that would be brought with the Savior. See in your outline the Sabbath in the New Covenant. The Sabbath in the New Covenant. Now, even before I expound the New Testament scriptures, what would we expect from what we've learned already? That the Sabbath is a creation ordinance as a weekly observation, that it has a special redemptive significance for God's people, and that redemptive significance gets manifested throughout the symbolism and the system of Sabbath years and feast. Well, we would expect that when Christ comes, there will continue to be a weekly Sabbath as a creation ordinance. But with the accomplishment of redemption, there will be changes in the Sabbath practice of God's people. And we'll see if we don't find that to be the case. Is there a Sabbath in the New Covenant? Turn to Mark, the 2nd chapter. At the end of the 2nd chapter of Mark, we read that as Jesus was going through the grain fields on the Sabbath day, his disciples began to pluck the ears of grain there. And the Pharisees now bring accusation, why do they do what is not lawful on the Sabbath day? And Jesus answers them, first of all, with reference to the example of David, when he entered the house of God and ate the showbread. And I'm not going to go into all the ways in which that refutes their accusation. The application is made this way, verse 27. And he said unto them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So then, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Does Jesus here say, my disciples are allowed to pluck grain because there's no more Sabbath requirement? That's the dispensational approach. No more Sabbath, so it's all right for followers of Jesus, the disciples of Jesus, to pluck the grain. That isn't what Jesus says. He says, I'm Lord of the Sabbath. What does it mean to be Lord of the Sabbath? In the first place, Lord is the New Testament translation for Adonai in Hebrew, and Adonai was the name substituted for Jehovah, for Yahweh, the name of God that the Jews superstitiously wouldn't pronounce. When Jesus claims to be Lord of the Sabbath, he is referring back to Exodus 20, where this is the Sabbath of Jehovah thy God. He says, I am the one that the Sabbath is all about. I am Lord of the Sabbath. And because he's Lord of the Sabbath, and the Sabbath was made for the good of man, then he can determine how the Sabbath is to be used. Now that's a much different defense than to say, well, yes, in the past that would have been a violation of the Sabbath, but don't you know, now that I've come, there's no more Sabbath. He doesn't say there's no more Sabbath. He says, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. I'm the one who determines what's right and wrong on the Sabbath. This is my day. This is the day of the Lord, the day of Jehovah. Now, if the Sabbath has passed away, then what is Jesus Lord over? See, those people who argue that there's no more Sabbath commandment empty Jesus' claim of any significance. He says, I'm Lord of the Sabbath, and there isn't any. And so Mark, the second chapter, is, I think, one of the best proofs that in the New Testament the Sabbath has not been canceled. It has not been canceled. Because Jesus continues to be the Lord of the Sabbath, which was given for the good of man. Has man changed? Does man no longer need a day of rest every seven? No. So for the good of man, and in recognition of the Lordship of Jesus Christ, the Sabbath does continue. Moreover, look at Hebrews, the fourth chapter. Hebrews chapter 4. The author of Hebrews in chapter 4 is talking about the threat of not entering into God's promised rest because of unbelief and sin. And he reminds us that some in the Old Testament did not enter into God's rest out of the wilderness because they had sinned. And then in verse 4 he says, For he hath said somewhere, on the seventh day, on this wise, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And in this place again, they shall not enter into my rest. Seeing therefore it remaineth that some should enter thereunto, and they to whom the good tidings were before preached failed to enter in because of disobedience, he again defines a certain day. Today, saying in David, so long a time afterwards, even as he had said before, Today, if you shall hear his voice, harden not your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken afterward of another day. So at this point, the author of Hebrews has made it clear that when the people entered the promised land, even that did not grant the rest that God had in mind. Because David speaks of that day as well. Verse 9, Therefore, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For he that has entered into his rest hath himself also rested from his works as God did from his. Let us therefore give diligence to enter into that rest, that no man fall after the same example of disobedience. The author of Hebrews tells us that as long as we have not entered the eschatological final day, as long as we have not entered into the new heavens and new earth to rest in God's kingdom, as long as we are still looking ahead to God's establishing that rest for his people, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Now, Remember, the Sabbath is a redemptive token. It points to God's kingdom, the salvation he gives, the redemption that he accomplishes. And the author of Hebrews in chapter 4 says, all of us are still working to enter into that rest. Just like Israel was in the wilderness, so we in this world are to keep moving on. The exhortation is for us to press in, to enter in to God's rest. And as long as the final day has not come, the final day of redemption, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Where the Sabbath rest means a Sabbath day, there remains a Sabbath day rest for the people of God. So we continue to observe a Sabbath day in anticipation of our final redemption, that which we are laboring in faithfulness to God to enter into. And one more text, Revelation 1. At the 10th verse, John, in his introduction to the giving of this revelation, says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a great voice. John identifies when he received this revelation, and he says it was on the day of the Lord, the Lord's day. Now, what is the Lord's day? What did Jesus say? I am the Lord of the Sabbath. The Lord of the Sabbath. The Lord's day is the day in which Christ's lordship is made evident. And when was that made evident? What day of the week? When Jesus rose from the dead, which declared him to be Lord over all. And so John here speaks of a special day of the week called the Lord's day, and we know from New Testament history that that would be the day Sunday, the first day of the week. So is there a Sabbath in the New Covenant? Sure there is. It's still a creation ordinance. Creation hasn't changed. There may be a redemptive change because Christ has brought what the Sabbath was looking forward to. But there is a continuing Sabbath, a weekly Sabbath rest of God's people. Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. Hebrews 4 says, as long as we're awaiting the final day of consummation, there is a Sabbath rest for God's people. And John identifies that day in Revelation 1:9 when he talks very easily and without explanation of being in the Spirit on the Lord's day, the day of the Lord. Okay, another question then. What about day keeping? Doesn't the New Covenant discourage day-keeping? In Romans 14, Paul says, one man accounts a day and another day, and another man doesn't. Let every man be convinced in his own mind. Is Romans 14, therefore, an abrogation of the Sabbath in the New Covenant? Well, you already have some very strong reasons for thinking otherwise. First, it's a creation ordinance, so it wouldn't be canceled. Two, Jesus affirms the Sabbath. Three, Hebrews 4 affirms the Sabbath. Revelation 1 affirms the Sabbath. So what could Paul be referring to? It's my own conviction that Paul is not talking about the weekly Sabbath, but he's talking about other holy days, other ceremonies, other ritual feasts of the Jews, or even of others who have the idea that maybe we ought to celebrate Christmas, let's say. A holy day. And Paul says, let every man be convinced in his own mind. But it's not obligatory. If you want to keep the Jewish holy days, Christ is the fulfillment of those things, then that's okay. But Paul says, when he talks about every day being the same, he is not, I think, referring to the weekly Sabbath. He's referring to these added on Sabbath, the days of Sabbath significance within the system of Jewish ceremonies and rituals. Moreover, in Colossians chapter 2, it sounds as though to some people that the Sabbath has been put aside. Let me turn to that with you. Colossians 2. In verse 16, Paul says, "Let no man therefore judge you in meat or drink, in respect of feast day or new moon or Sabbath day, which are a shadow of the things to come, but the body, the substance, is Christ." Whatever Paul's referring to must encompass some requirement about meat, drink, feast day, new moon, and Sabbath. Now, when people say, "Oh yeah, that's the ceremonial laws of the Old Testament," the problem is there are no dietary laws pertaining to drink in the Old Testament. And so that makes it look a little, I mean, that is a common interpretation, but you want to take a second look at it, because that doesn't fit. There are no drink restrictions in the ceremonial law of the Old Testament. So what is Paul referring to? Well, it turns out that there are offerings in the Old Testament, which are called meat offerings and drink offerings. There are offerings for feast days, offerings for new moon, and offerings for Sabbath day, all mentioned in the Old Testament. Now, if you interpret it that way, that Paul's referring to this, and we're not referring to the Sabbath day at all, but rather the offerings of the law, which are a shadow of the things to come. That is, they foreshadow Christ and all of his benefits to us in redemption. So then, I don't believe that we find in the New Testament text which abrogate the weekly Sabbath. Though we do have texts that tell us we don't have to keep the Sabbath offerings, nor do we have to follow the system of the Sabbath, the other festivals of the Jews and so forth. Every man can be convinced in his own mind about that. But Paul knows that every day is really the same. One last question about Sabbath. What about the change of day? Why is there a change of day from Saturday to Sunday? And the answer is twofold. One, by apostolic example, and then secondly, by Old Testament anticipation. First, by apostolic example. Second, by Old Testament anticipation. The apostles worshipped on the first day of the week. We know that from New Testament reading. And we infer from this that since they are spokesmen for Christ and the foundation of the church, that the church itself imitates the apostles in taking this as their day of rest, its day of rest, because Christ was raised on the first day of the week. We take the day of Christ's resurrection as the Lord's day, the day that declares his lordship, and make that our day of worship. But secondly, I would maintain that if you understood the Old Testament, you would have anticipated a change of the day to the eighth day. Remember what I said earlier about the Feast of Pentecost and so forth, which, when God brings redemption, when he brings in the new creation, resurrection represents the new creation. When God brings this in, it will be an eighth day celebration. So instead of Saturday, the seventh, it's celebrated on the eighth day, the day of resurrection and new creation. Okay, questions about the Sabbath that you would like to ask?
So is it breaking the commandment, therefore, to have, like, seventh day Adventist worship on Saturday?
I believe that it is contrary to biblical teaching to have Christian, I mean, you can worship on Saturday in a voluntary way, mm-hmm. but the day of the duty to worship is fulfilled on the Lord's day now, and that by apostolic example. I don't believe the day that we worship is arbitrary or voluntary. Some people have said, well, you know, some people worship on this day, some on that. But I think we have to follow the pattern of God. That's what we see in creation ordinance. And we follow the pattern of Jesus' resurrection by worshiping on the day that the new creation comes in.
In the Old Testament, when they had every 7 years of the day when the land rested, were all their fields resting, i.e., you know, just every single one of them, or did they have some sort of rotation? Was it symbolic of complete and total trust, or did they have, I mean...
Yeah, well, some people have suggested as a modern application,
yeah,
rotating your fields so that a particular spot of land every 7 years gets rest. However, in the Old Testament, the Sabbath year was uniform. I think all of the fields were to rest the Sabbath year. And when Israel would not keep the Sabbath years and observe the Jubilee, how did God enforce it? He said, I'll take you into captivity, and I will give the land the rest that you refused it, and so you'll be in captivity to cover all the jubilees that were denied it. So that too suggests that it was to be uniform. Other questions?
This kind of does away with the notion of, well, it doesn't matter so long as I rest in 7 days.
Yes, it does. There is some support in the law. For instance, if a man couldn't be present at the time of Passover, that he could do Passover because he's traveling at another time and so forth. And so we may have to make provision for people who cannot be available on Sunday to worship, those who are doctors or firemen or policemen, something like that. And I didn't get into any of the detailed questions. None of you have asked me, though, how we're supposed to keep the Sabbath. Well, in the first place, you're supposed to avoid your regular work. So if you're students, you're not supposed to study on Sunday, which brings up the irony, and I would say this to seminarians and Bible school students as well. If your 6 days of labor is to study the Bible, on Sunday you're not to study your lessons of the Bible, you're to study the Bible, but you're not to do your homework for school, even though it's Bible homework, on Sunday. Okay, so we don't do our ordinary labors on Sunday. We are to use the day in a restful fashion. Now, does that leave any leeway for people resting in different manners? I know people who relax when they go, say, into the backyard and they work on their bonsai trees, you know, trimming them, or, you know, do some weeding and things like that. I mean, it's relaxing. It's hard for me to use that illustration because even saying it, I'm going inside, how could anyone relax weeding? I hate weeding. I hate yard work. Okay? To me, it would not be relaxing, joyful. It would be laborious. But do I not have to grant that somebody else could have a different personality and they genuinely could enter into the rest of the Lord and be relaxing in doing that? I have to grant that's possible. Obviously, I don't want to open the door to everybody just using their own little excuse, you know, saying, well, for me it's restful, so yeah, I can go out and run 50 miles. Now, it's unlikely that if you're, you know, doing that and beating your body and trying to build up your muscles that you're really resting, okay?
What about recreational sports?
Okay.
Like a basketball,
especially for something. Okay. If it is an expression of fellowship, it seems to me that's appropriate.
Not professional sports, like.
But professional sports is what? Making your living in a way which is not pleasing to God, because you're working on His day. And so, let me tell you some of the anomalies if you try working out these principles. And the anomalies may tell some people, well, Bonson's just wrong, we have to be more categorical. But in trying to draw the fine distinctions, I would say that for some people, less than people usually think, but for some people, it's not inappropriate to watch a sporting event on the TV on Sunday. Now remember, it is wrong for people on Sunday, professional athletes, to be doing what they're doing. But remember, you're not doing what they're doing when you're watching the TV. You're relaxing. You're being entertained. And VCRs help make this point real well. I mean, for all practical purposes, you're relaxing by watching a football game on Sunday afternoon. Could be you're watching a tape of somebody playing on Saturday. Okay? It so happens you're not, but that just indicates that it's not really that they're playing on Sunday is the point. It's that it's entertainment coming through the box to you. Now, of course, they will answer for playing on Sunday. So, well, then you're encouraging the play. Well, that's just not true. It's not true. They don't even know if you're watching the game or not, unless you happen to be one of those, how many thousands, you know, of homes have the box in the TV that tells, if you're one of the Nielsen families, then that would be a different story. But since most of us are not, that's not a general principle to be applied here. Now, I say some people could watch football games and genuinely be relaxing. My experience is most people get pretty worked up watching football games, and it's not an expression of worship and relaxation in the Lord. Okay? But I'm just granting that's a possibility. Professional football players ought not to play. However, some Christians could watch a TV game on Sunday. Could you play football on Sunday at a church picnic? I actually preached a sermon once that was aimed at answering that question. We were going on a church picnic after church, and is it all right to go out and play football together? My answer is, if you don't do it in a competitive spirit, if you do it as a form of recreation and fellowship, fine. What do I mean, not a competitive spirit? The Lord's Day is to draw us together in worship, not to separate us as, hey, we beat you. Now, some people say, well, what's the good of playing? To which I say, well, that's fine. If that's your reason for playing football, don't do it on Sunday. Okay, I think that I'm right in these things, and I ask God for wisdom, and I don't want to mislead God's people to break his commandments, obviously. But I think those are the sorts of distinctions you have to draw when you ask the question, how should the day be kept?
Would this not also apply to, since this is an example you always find at work, to like steel mills? You can't,
yeah, that's a tough one.
Down,
what do you, yeah, this, allegedly it takes more than 7 days to fire up the steel mills. And, so they don't turn them off, because even if they did, they'd have to go through a Sabbath day getting them stoked up again. I really wish I could take the time to research and to write on that. I've struggled with it for a number of years, but I haven't come to a place where I feel like I can say, cut and dry, here's the answer sort of thing. But it may be that modern society has things like that where for the benefit of subduing the created order and pleasing God, it's a work of necessity to keep the mills fired up. And so there has to be a skeleton crew for safety's sake there on Sundays and so forth. Now, the problem is, of course, the steel mill people, seeing that they can't close down, then it's just kind of like, well, there's no regulation, just, you know, full workforce and all that. But maybe a case could be made for keeping them open. But I'd want to research it more.
Would it be possible to set up a system where only a certain amount each month had to work, so that they had only one Sunday that they had to work?
Oh, sure, sure. And even if you do have to keep the steel mills open, then you should be making provisions for the skeleton crew to rotate so their religious freedoms are observed. They have the opportunity to worship. What's that?
See to it so they can get off for either morning or an evening service.
Yeah, or not have to work some Sundays at all, because everyone has to take their turn, you know, being on the skeleton crew, but not everyone has to be there every Sunday, something like that.
Which would be a good case for having communion on every Sunday that way. And every time you meet on Sundays too, that way you can have people, the day after work, will be able to take communion.
Yeah. Well, that's another question about taking weekly communion, which I do support, but we won't get into that just now. Okay, in our last few minutes here, let me read to you. I wish we had a copy of the larger catechism available. I couldn't fit it in my luggage just for the sake. But let me read from the shorter catechism something about the scope of the fifth commandment. What is the fifth commandment? The fifth commandment is, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Now before we go on, let's notice something about the statement of the commandment. The commandment requires more than just obedience to our parents and our superiors. Isn't that right? More than just obedience. Is it possible for a child to obey his parents and still not honor them? Yeah, begrudging obedience, or a sarcastic obedience, or a obedience just because you have to. This refers to something, this tells us something about how righteousness comes from the heart. We are to honor our parents. It's a matter of attitude as well as the outward performance. And the promise that is made, Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 6, this is the first commandment with promise. Isn't that interesting? The promise is your days will be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Does that mean that every individual who honors his father and mother lives long? No, this is a corporate command and a corporate promise. The days that will be long will be the days for your culture, or as a generalization, you as a people will have long lives because you honor your authorities. There are some people who have honored their mother and their father and they've lived short lives, but that is not a contradiction to the command, which is meant in a corporate sense. Notice, thirdly, that your days will be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. This is a promise in Jewish context that you'll live long in Palestine. Now what does Paul do in Ephesians the 6th chapter though when he quotes this verse? I want you to notice how he changes it. He refers to the promise element of it, but then he changes the wording. Ephesians 6:1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. On the earth. Here Paul changes the reference from the land, Palestine, to the earth in general. He universalizes the promise. That's rather significant in another way, because it shows that for Paul, what God was doing in the promised land was only a small picture for the larger whole. That the kingdom of Israel was but a model for the whole earth. He thinks of land being universalized into earth. But Paul universalizes the promise so that all people, whether they live in Palestine or not, participate in the promise of this commandment. Okay, now, what is required in the fifth commandment? The shorter catechism says, the fifth commandment requires the preserving the honor and performing the duties belonging to everyone in their several places and relations as superiors, inferiors, or equals. According to the Puritans, you look at this commandment, it says you are to honor your social relations, whether you are subordinate to someone, whether you have authority over someone, or whether you're equal to someone in your social setting. What is forbidden in the fifth commandment? The fifth commandment forbids the neglecting of or doing anything against the honor and duty which belongs to everyone in their several places and relations. If we do things contrary to honoring our superiors, we neglect to do the duty which belongs to them, we have violated the commandment. really wish we had the larger catechism, because it gives a long list of illustrations than how this is done. Who are styled father and mother, according to the larger catechism? Well, it turns out that father and mother stand for anyone who's in authority over us, including magistrates, ministers, teachers, what have you. And so honor your father and mother is interpreted by the Puritans, using the rest of the scripture to elaborate on this, that you show honor and you obey the civil magistrate, or the elders in the church, or the teacher that is set over you by your parents, and so forth. What is the reason annexed to the fifth commandment? The reason annexed to the fifth commandment is a promise of long life and prosperity, as far as it shall serve for God's glory and their own good, to all such as keep this commandment. This raises an interesting question. The obvious duty of the fifth commandment is submission to those who are in authority over us. When may we refuse such obedience? When is it appropriate not to obey those who are in authority over us? When can we say no to our parents? When can we say no to the civil magistrate? And you know the answer from Acts, the fifth chapter. We must obey God rather than men. When those who are in authority over us command us to violate the commandments of God, then we may disobey those who are in authority over us. Is there ever a time when it is appropriate to revolt against constituted authority? Let's think of the civil magistrate first of all. Is there ever a place for Christians to engage in revolution? Well, it would be very rare. If the magistrate tells us to do something contrary to God's word, we refuse to do what the magistrate says. But that doesn't in itself tell us we have the right to take up arms against those who are in authority. This means we aren't going to do what they tell us to. At what point would God's people have the right to take up arms? And it takes a lot of, you know, analysis of these issues to come to the conclusion, but let me jump to that conclusion. I believe the only time it's right for God's people to violate the commands of their rulers is when there is no just means of recourse against them. When there is no just means of recourse against them. So, in English and American society, if the magistrate should be oppressing the people, we would be able to bring a grievance against the magistrate, either by electing someone else, or even if elections are not available, sometimes bringing a suit in a court of law to require that the magistrate lay off. But now, what if you live in a country like Idi Amin's Uganda, where there is no recourse at all, and the magistrate is oppressing you? Then I would argue, when all those conditions are met, that when you have no lawful means of recourse, and you are being oppressed, that it's a matter of self-defense, which God allows you. You may defend yourself by taking up arms against the oppressive regime. And so it would have to be very extreme circumstances, wouldn't it, before a Christian would be morally allowed to revolt. You'd have to exhaust all lawful means of redress. Okay? And it would have to be a matter of self-defense. Let's bring it a little closer to home. When may someone who's trying to please God say to his father and mother, no? Well, obviously if you're being required to sin. But what if they aren't requiring you to sin? Let me give you a situation that I've had this happen three, maybe four times since the time I've been a pastor. You have a young person living at home, say, a young lady, 22, 23 years old, and she decides she wants to move out of the house, she wants to get her own apartment. Her father says, no, I don't want you to. Well, he's not requiring her to sin. It's not a sin to live at home with your father. May she revolt against his authority and say, well, Father, I'm sorry, you can no longer require that of me, and I'm going to go out on my own. Well, what lawful means of recourse does she have, ideally? Who could this be taken to for wisdom and adjudication?
Pastor
and elders of the church. Exactly. Go to the elders and you say, I love my father. I honor his authority. He says, however, I cannot do this. It seems to me that he's overbearing. This is not biblical. And I should have the freedom to do this. Okay, so there may be one way to adjudicate it. But let's say that the elders can't come up with an answer, or the elders won't engage in it at all, or you're not in a church where there are elders to do it. Back to the moral question. When may someone revolt against constituted authority? Can a father keep his daughter at home forever? Keep her from getting married and so forth? No, if she were marrying, some, you might have a better case, right? She's establishing a new family and she's not under his authority anymore. But now let me make it harder. What if she wants to marry and he says no? Okay, if she wants to marry an unbeliever and he's trying to enforce Christian standards, we don't have any problem with that. What if the guy's a real fine Christian? Dad just doesn't like him. Or worse, this happens every once in a while, no one will ever be good enough for his daughter. He may not say that, but it's just a matter that he doesn't want his daughter getting married at 23. He wants her to wait till she's 30, or so he says, and at 30 he'll have another excuse. Is it ever right for a Christian young person or young adult like that to say, I do honor you, I wish to obey you in everything that is lawful, but you have exceeded your authority and you're now oppressing me in my life and I'm going to have to make my own decision? Oh, I see you all struggle with that. I do too. It's hard. My answer is yes. At some point, parents are exasperating their children, and they do not have the right to do that. I would not ever be quick to draw that conclusion, but I would say in the same way that at the extreme end there is a place for political revolution when there's no other means of redress, at some point in a young adult's life, he or she might, in a godly, respectful fashion, have to say, this is exasperation. This is not a matter of honoring my parents. They don't have the right to impose this on me. And you move out. You take the consequences of establishing your own new life, whether it's through marriage or not through marriage. It's sad that when we have so little time to talk about the fifth commandment, we have to focus upon what amounts to the exception to the rule. But that's because the other cases should be rather clear to us as to what to do. So I'm just taking up for your time, which is valuable, the difficult cases, the exceptional ones. Would you like to ask any questions? We're going to stop for the day at this point. Any last questions on the fourth or fifth commandments? No? Okay, well then tomorrow we'll make it our aim to go through commandments 6, 7, and 8. I'm not going to get to 9 and 10, I know that, because there's going to be plenty to do on commands 6, 7, and 8. And somewhere we'll have to work in there a discussion of political issues like capital punishment and war as a way of reviewing for those of you who forgot that it's already been done.